Court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. Call our last case for the January calendar, 03-1781 CR State v. Brent Reed, representing Mr. Reed is David Weber. Mr. Weber?
Chief Justice, members of the court, Mr. Becker, may it please the court, good afternoon. My name is David Weber, and I represent the appellant petitioner, Brent Reed, in this case. The narrow issue presented by this case is whether false statements, false denials, in response to police questioning are criminal under Wisconsin statute section 946.41. There are three reasons why the answer to that question is no. The legislature never intended that kind of conduct to be criminalized under this statute, and that is reflected by Court of Appeals opinion, State v. Espinoza, some language from this Court's opinion in State v. Peters, and various Federal Circuit courts and other decisions, which obviously we'll get to. The U.S. Supreme Court has gone the other direction eventually in that area.
Now, are you talking about just an exculpatory no doctrine generally, or are you talking about this case? You're talking about your case?
Yes, I am, Justice
okay.
Wilcox.
Then if you're talking about your case, I would like to ask you whether or not you feel that just saying no is okay, but in your case, it went beyond that. No, I was not driving, but so-and-so was, go find him. Now, doesn't that expand the no doctrine?
Our position, Judge, is that, Justice Wilcox, is that it does not expand a meaningful exculpatory no doctrine. It is more than going, more than just simply responding with a no. But the reason why I say that, Justice Wilcox, is because Mr. Reed's responses were answers that he gave to questions posed by the police to explain his circumstances in which he was confronted with incriminating evidence. He was found along the highway alone in his vehicle in an admittedly intoxicated condition. And as the trial court itself, and we were before Judge Rehm, he acknowledged as much that someone in that position would certainly, if they're going to deny having driven the vehicle, and the police officer asked them, well, then who had driven it there, would be faced with the dilemma of having to give an answer if he's going to carry out admittedly a false explanation for his circumstances that he found himself in. So I understand your point, Justice Wilcox, but our position in this case is that his responses, albeit false and beyond no, were simply answers given in response to interrogation and confrontation by the authorities, that they weren't truly voluntary statements in the sense that
He had the right to say no and then say nothing.
He did, Justice Wilcox.
But the concern here is that they expended time and effort, and to me it seems to fall outside of it, just the doctrine.
I understand that. We disagree respectfully, Justice Wilcox, because it's our position that actually Reed's statements did not waste police resources. They did not do anything outside, cause the police to have to do anything other than their ordinary duties, which are to pursue an investigation and pursue all avenues and leads that might be available. I think that Mr. Reed did himself an extreme disservice, as far as any defense lawyer would take a position, by giving a false explanation for where he was at.
Maybe I'm missing something, but didn't the police in this case, based on the statement, go out and look for Mr. Triller, initially not find him, and then later talk to him that evening?
What happened, Justice Butler, is that Mr. Reed denied that he had been driving, and then they asked him to perform some field sobriety tests. He refused to do it, again saying that he hadn't been driving, and they arrested him. On their way to the police station, I believe the facts or the police report shows, and it's not in the criminal complaint, but that's when they looked along the highway, didn't see anybody. That was the extent of their search. And then after giving Mr. Reed a breathalyzer, taking his blood or whatever they did, they then gave Mr. Reed his one phone call and actually took the phone call for Mr. Reed, called his brother, said, do you know this third party? Eventually tracked him down through a couple of their calls to other relatives and got a hold of Mr. Triller and asked him whether he'd been with Reed that, with Mr. Reed that night. So
now, aren't those activities that they would not have done but for the statement?
That's right, Justice Butler, but they would have had a weaker case had Mr. Reed not said those statements. So the fact of the matter is the police are pursuing their investigation, and all along the way they're foreclosing any ability for Mr. Reed to have a defense in the case, and they're just simply doing their job. Nobody was accused of doing any wrongdoing by Mr. Reed's statements. Mr. Reed didn't want the police to find Mr. Triller. It wasn't his anticipation or intended purpose for them to get in touch with Mr. Triller and talk to him. Based on the context of the facts as alleged in this complaint, we believe that Mr. Reed did not intend to mislead the police into taking those investigative steps. Okay. It was against his interest to do so.
How can you say that he didn't accuse him of doing any wrongdoing when Triller, if what your client said was true and they found Triller and he had, let's say he, this was, I don't know how many hours, but 3-4 hours afterward, and he was intoxicated and he had been accused of driving that vehicle, although they didn't see him. I guess the point is that he was being accused by your client, at least, of operating that vehicle.
Under those circumstances, we wouldn't be here with this argument, Justice Wilcox. We would submit that that would certainly be a different circumstance where Mr. Reed would have perverted the legitimate governmental functions by implicating another person in wrongdoing. And certainly in that situation, that's totally different than we have here, but an appropriate instance of criminal obstruction. And that's our position. There's a distinction here in that there wasn't a Mr. Triller anywhere nearby. There wasn't an intoxicated Mr. Triller. Those facts, as shown in this complaint, aren't present. What I mean to say is that the complaint doesn't allege those kind of facts. What it alleges is that Mr. Reed was immediately disbelieved, that he was arrested summarily, that the police followed the track, that he, when he gave those statements, they followed the path down the line and foreclosed his defense. So now Mr. Reed has less of a possibility for a defense, and if he would have just simply said, no, I plead not guilty, instead of saying I wasn't driving, he could have simply said, if his lawyer was there, I plead not guilty, and said nothing more, and the police would have been in a worse position. The prosecution would have been in a worse position than they are at this stage, where they have now taken Mr. Reed's statements, they can admit them as consciousness of guilt evidence, they can foreclose the fact that this is what actually happened and prove that his statements were false. And so he's going to have no...
Mr. Weber, perhaps the problem with your argument, is, as I see it, is if we take it to its logical conclusion that what he was trying to do was not intend to have the police find Triller, but just trying to exculpate himself. Well, isn't that true of all defendants who lie when they're caught, that they say that they're trying not to be caught? Isn't that the same situation? And if that's so, wouldn't that then render the obstructing statute as meaningless?
Well, it is our position that the obstructing justice statute was not written for this kind of conduct. In any instance where a defendant gave a false statement to exculpate himself from the circumstance in which he was found, if they are statements that the defendant has or suspect is giving that are implausible, not likely to be believed, and otherwise don't put anyone else in danger of being a suspect or being investigated and put through the inconvenience of obviously having to explain their circumstances, then you've got a situation where the person is not done anything other than harm his own cause. The police have merely fulfilled their function by doing a proper and thorough investigation, and the defendant is going to be always in those situations prosecuted under the underlying offense. So what you've got is the police are not going to be able to manufacture another criminal charge. The state is not going to add on an obstruction charge in every one of these situations where an individual is caught making a false statement about his circumstances. He's going to be obviously prosecuted for that underlying offense. So it's our...
Counsel, I want to interrupt you a minute. What if my law clerk is contacted by the police who says there's been a hit and run, and police ask her, was your husband driving your van yesterday? The van matches the description of the vehicle. And she knows he was driving it, but she says no. Can she be prosecuted under the obstructing statute?
Justice Rosenstein, I haven't thought through that scenario entirely at this point, but my immediate response would be she could be, because she's not giving an exculpatory denial. She isn't denying her own criminal wrongdoing. She's denying the wrongdoing of her husband in that situation.
So you hear, but if that's true, then a person that's committed no crime who tells the truth, the police a falsehood, can be prosecuted, but a person who has committed a crime and tells the police a falsehood can't be prosecuted. That seems a little bit odd to me.
Well, they can be prosecuted for the underlying offense. Whether there's going to be an obstruction charge on top of that.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Well, and our argument is that there shouldn't be this piling on of charges. It doesn't serve any real purpose beyond just piling on charges against the accused and taking the obstruction statute and using it for a purpose that it, and conduct that it wasn't intended to cover. Now, whether this wife should also be able to claim the exculpatory no on behalf of her husband because it's a statement that she gives in sort of a reactionary fashion, albeit not the morally correct decision, a decision she makes without understanding that by doing that she's committing a criminal act, that's another question. And our position is that it's not covered on the exculpatory no because it's not an exculpatory statement. So whether it also is something that shouldn't be criminal conduct under the obstruction statute, I would actually, on further contemplation, assert that it isn't, her response is not an intended act to mislead the police. Really what she's doing is simply trying to deny the offense for her husband. So
I fail to see the difference, counsel.
Well, the elements of obstruction, 946.41 sub 2A, requires the false statements be made with the intention to mislead the police.
Well, isn't that what she's doing? And Justice Rogan said she's trying to mislead them. They asked her, what was your husband driving? And she said no, knowing that he was. Now,
our position is that under 939.23, the intent is defined. The mental purpose would have to be determined by the facts as alleged and the context under which the individual is making the statement. So if it was implausible that the wife's denial was going to be believed, then our case law, this court's own case law, has interpreted situations where someone has made or done something that is or taken an act where the intended consequence is so implausible and not possible to occur that that may not be a situation where intent is actually formed.
Aren't you talking about the failure to take an act in that case? You're talking about Hamilton, right?
I'm sorry?
You're talking about State versus Hamilton, right?
State versus Hamilton is a situation where, as I recall, the individual refused to give his identification. And this court found that that was an obstruction of justice because the police could legitimately find the identity of this person by inquiring of someone that was cooperating with the police.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Weber. You brought up the question of elements of the offense. What are the elements here?
There's four elements according to the jury instruction, which is 1766A, and the third element, I could go through each all four of them. The first is that the accused knowingly give false information to an officer. The second element is that the officer was acting in the official capacity. The third element is that the officer was doing an act with lawful authority. And fourth, that the defendant intended to mislead the officer in the performance of his or her duty. So it's
where did we say that?
Where this court where has this court adopted the jury instruction?
Where has that court adopted that definition of the offense?
This court has, well, certainly in the Court of Appeals in Caldwell has adopted the jury instruction, the criminal jury instruction 1766A. I'm not sure if this court has ever.
Actually, wasn't the 1766A created after Caldwell?
in response to Caldwell?
My recollection is that it was cited in Caldwell. I may be wrong, but it certainly was cited in State versus Espinoza. So the Court of Appeals certainly relied on it, said the fourth element in State versus Espinoza was the element that was lacking when the Espinoza defendant falsely denied having stolen the tire and told the police that he was going to sue them if they continued to pursue him.
How has this Court defined obstructing? What elements have we attached to obstructing?
I don't know if this Court has ever specifically adopted the criminal jury instruction. I do know in State versus Peters, this Court instructed district attorneys to have sound reasons to charge, if a district attorney is going to charge obstruction of justice, they should have sound reasons to believe that the suspect gave false information with the intent, mental purpose to deceive the police, to mislead the police, rather than out of a good faith desire to defend against an accusation of crime. And I think where you get into the good faith and the bad faith effort by someone to defend against the accusation of a crime is where you have a situation, if this case would be different and Mr. Reed would have accused Mr. Triller, who was walking down the highway, of having driven the vehicle and he was found in an intoxicated condition, that would be a bad faith instance where Mr. Reed would have tried to defend himself against the accusation of crime but perverted the legitimate police function by implicating another in criminal wrongdoing. And specifically, that is a point of our contention with the Court of Appeals decision in this case, where in the first paragraph the Court wrote that where a suspect goes beyond saying no and identifies another suspect or a possible suspect, he goes too far and the exculpatory denial exception should not apply. Mr. Reed did not, it's our position, we respectfully submit, did not identify another possible suspect. He stated a name when he was asked who had been driving. He did not even provide the police with the information that led to Mr. Triller. It was only the police officer's effort to talk to his brother and relatives to find Mr. Triller in the end that led to them actually speaking with Mr. Triller and foreclosing the defense that Mr. Reed had attempted to assert on his behalf.
Mr. Weber, you started out but didn't get too far, giving us three reasons, if I remember.
Thank you.
One is that the legislature didn't intend to criminalize this kind of statement. What's your second reason?
The second reason is the cruel trilemma or spirit of the Fifth Amendment kind of argument that we advanced, that the defendant really doesn't have a true right. Well, let me rephrase that. The defendant has the three options when faced with criminal circumstances that he's found in and is cornered and asked questions. He can either lie, he can either tell the truth, or he can remain silent. I've cited a number of cases in the briefing which talk about the illusory or the real practical reality of someone faced in those circumstances about their ability to remain silent. And I cite Berkmer versus McCarty, a U.S. Supreme Court case in 1984 in which the court wrote, the area of the oral authority of a law enforcement officer coupled with a suspect's knowledge that the officer has the discretion to take enforcement action exerts pressure on the detainee to answer and respond to the questions. The U.S. Supreme Court in Moran versus Burbine has similar language. And the point is that the individual in these circumstances often gives a reactionary response, albeit a false one, a morally incorrect response, but doesn't realize that they are incriminating themselves in yet another offense. And they believe that if they remain silent, the officer is going to take that as an admission of guilt. It's going to warrant further police enforcement and investigations, could get them in more trouble. They're going to be arrested because the police officer in Reed's situation would have just simply arrested him if he would have said, I plead not guilty, and not said anything else.
Mr. Weber, don't you have some real problem arguing the Fifth Amendment or even the spirit of the Fifth Amendment given the Brogan decision by the U.S. Supreme Court?
I certainly do have some trouble with that, but I would assert that there are other instances in which this Court has departed from the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation, and there were two dissenters in that decision in Brogan, as well as two concurrences which were very critical of the decision of the Court,
And you're making an argument also under Article I, Section 8 of the Wisconsin Constitution?
Yes, we have cited that in our briefing as well, Justice Crooks.
Let me ask you, I know you're basing a lot of your argument on Espinoza, and isn't the Espinoza case under serious, what do I want to say? It's can be seriously questioned because of the fact that Espinoza was based on an Illinois decision, which now apparently has been overruled by the Illinois Supreme Court in another case. In other words, I think the sequence is Brooks followed by Ellis. Ellis is a very recent decision of the Illinois Supreme Court, which rejects this exception. Doesn't that really weaken Espinoza?
It does to some extent. There's other states, which we've cited in our briefing as well, including in Idaho, Maryland, Montana, New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania, where states have interpreted statutes similar to this one in Wisconsin, albeit they include an element of usually of some sort of voluntariness on behalf of the suspect who is charged, voluntarily giving false information to the police. And so those courts have said, well, when the individual is confronted or cornered and interrogated by police and he responds falsely, he's not really volunteering information falsely. So those cases could be distinguished as well. And you're right to say that the Illinois Supreme Court has gone the other direction in this case, but we've also pointed out in our briefing that the Illinois Supreme Court took a hard look at the policy considerations that were in place in that case, and there are some distinguishing factors in this one, specifically that Reed in this situation did not intend to give misleading information that was plausibly going to lead to the inconvenience or investigation of someone else. Here, again, it was only after he was arrested that the police continued to do their work. They didn't need that information to arrest him. They had sufficient belief to probable cause to arrest him. We haven't challenged that arrest at this point. This, of course, this is an interlocutory appeal, but the point is that Mr. Reed simply gave statements that were immediately disbelieved by the police, and there was really no perversion of the governmental function. And I will cite to the court another U.S. Supreme Court case, Sherman versus the United States, in which the U.S. Supreme Court indicated that the purpose of law enforcement is the prevention and apprehension of criminals. Manifestly, that purpose is not the manufacture of crime. Here, the legislature never intended for a defendant's false or suspect's false statements to constitute another criminal offense. And that goes to the third point that I wanted to raise with the court today, and that is that even if you don't buy our argument that under the reading of the statute, the literal reading of the statute, this type of conduct isn't criminal under 946.41, if you follow it out to the extent the state would have you do, it would lead to absurd results that clearly the legislature wouldn't have intended. And those results I point to are instances where a prosecutor or a law enforcement officer could ratchet up a minor offense, otherwise minor offense, based on a cavalier or flippant response by somebody who's asked a question when they're confronted with circumstances such as a civil violation like a speeding ticket. And they're asked, what speed were you going? And someone says, I was going 60, and the officer has them clocked at 65 or 70, and next thing you know, they're charged with obstruction of justice for lying about it. They've gone beyond saying no, but they've provided a bit of false information, which if you think that is intended to mislead a police officer rather than just simply to deny criminal wrongdoing or civil wrongdoing, then you've got a situation where someone could be charged with a criminal misdemeanor. And that is, in our estimation, based on the underlying principles that the legislature had in mind when it adopted this statute back in 1957, that is far afield from what they intended to be criminal conduct.
Do you have any legislative history that supports your position?
What I have is the statements from this court, from the statements of the U.S. Supreme Court, from all the eight circuits, the eight federal circuit courts in the last 30-some years, which it did adopt this exculpatory denial exception, that those are the underlying fundamental principles that the society believed in at that time, that there was really no intention by legislatures when they adopted these kind of statutes in the Model Penal Code and other states that have followed the Model Penal Code more closely, they did not intend to criminalize a suspect's false response in a situation like this.
Well, does our statute come from the Model Penal Code?
I don't believe it does track the Model Penal Code precisely. I did some research on that, and I cited that in our reply brief. I think in 1955, the statute was first adopted as a resisting an officer statute, and then 2 years later, in 1957, the obstruction false information part was added. That's the extent of there was no other indication that I could find in the legislative history research I did on in terms of what the legislature intended as far as false information and any limitations on that.
Does the record indicate who owned the vehicle in which Mr. Reed was found?
I don't recall if the criminal complaint does. I think it does, though, and I can find the answer to that question for you, Justice Prosser. But I know that certainly the discovery materials indicate that this was Reed's car. And I think that's in the complaint, but I may recall wrong.
What would be the result at a trial if the defendant took the stand and was asked, were you driving? And the person said no. Just nothing more than no.
Well, theoretically, if that was proven to be false, he could be charged with perjury, false swearing. And that there are situations in which this court has considered questions similar to that and found the same. I could think of a recent case in which this court reviewed whether an individual could be charged with perjury or false swearing after being acquitted on the underlying offense based on new information and actually concluded that the person could be.
Mr. Webber, your time is up.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General David Becker representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, as the Chief Justice has just indicated, my name is David Becker. I'm the Assistant Attorney General, and I appear here this afternoon on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, the State of Wisconsin. There are really two issues before this Court, as we presented them in our brief, and they've both been addressed in both parties' briefs. The first one, really the threshold issue, is whether or not this Court should overrule the Espinoza decision, which adopted the exculpatory no doctrine. We say that's the threshold issue because the defendant's whole argument here for dismissal of the complaint is based on the fact, or on his allegation at least, that what he did falls within that exception. So if this Court were to find that that exception should not exist under Wisconsin law, it presently does as a result of the Espinoza decision, but if this Court should overrule Espinoza, then that would end the matter. The defendant would have no basis, I don't believe, any further for contending that this complaint should have been dismissed. If this Court declines to overrule Espinoza, then you'll have to address the second issue, and that is, did Mr. Reed's conduct fall within the exculpatory no exception? I don't think I want to spend a whole lot of my time this afternoon on that second issue. I think that has been fairly explored in the questioning opposing counsel. I myself cannot conceive of how you could find these kind of affirmative misrepresentations that were made to fall within the exculpatory no exception. We've cited authority in our brief for that proposition. Opposing counsel himself admits that if this had been a case of the defendant accusing somebody else of what would have been criminal conduct on that person's part, the defendant had said he was doing, that he would not find it to fall within the exculpatory no exception. In other words, maybe more directly, if he inculpated another person in the crime, then this would not fall within the exculpatory no exception. He says this is distinguishable, however, because he was not inculpating Mr. Triller, because we don't have any evidence that Mr. Triller was drunk. So his assertion that Mr. Triller was driving would not have been inculpating Mr. Triller. I can't, for purposes of the exculpatory no exception and the scope of its coverage, I cannot divine why that should make any difference. He's basically doing the same thing. He's saying that somebody else did what, if done by him, would have been criminal. He's saying that somebody else did that conduct. Now, that may not technically be speaking, be inculpating that other person, but it is, as far as I can see, the functional equivalent for purposes of determining the scope of the exculpatory no doctrine. So I think the opposing counsel's own concession basically defeats his argument, unless you can find some way of distinguishing those two situations that provides a principal basis for saying that the exculpatory no exception covers the one situation, the true inculpation situation, but doesn't cover the situation where the defendant points the finger at another person with regard to the conduct that is criminal if he himself committed it. I think that's all I'm going to say, unless I've got further questions on whether or not this case falls within the exculpatory no doctrine, if the exculpatory no doctrine survives this Court's consideration of this case. And I'm going to turn to what I labeled the threshold question, and that is whether or not this Court should overrule Espinoza.
Mr. Becker, before yes. you do that, isn't there yet a third issue that really is underlying this case? I asked Mr. Weber what the elements of the offense were, and he cited State versus Caldwell and gave me four. But as I understand our jurisprudence, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has on more than one occasion defined obstructing an officer, and has defined it in State versus Hamilton and in Hennis versus Morrissey as being, one, the defendant obstructed an officer, two, the officer was doing an act in his official capacity and with lawful authority, three, the defendant obstructed an officer believing, that is, knew or believed that he or she was obstructing an officer while the officer was acting in an official capacity and lawful authority. And in discussing the term obstructing, as the Court said in Hennis versus Morrissey, the action justifying an arrest for obstruction cannot simply inconvenience the official. The action must make a difference in an official's ability to perform an official act, citing to State versus Hamilton. As I read State versus Caldwell, Caldwell reads out that definition of the offense. Does the Court of Appeals have the authority, first, to redefine our jurisprudence in the absence of a statutory change?
The Court of Appeals had authority to do what it did. You've got to take a close look at the obstructing statute, and you will find that that statute recreates what I will label, for want of a better term, two species of obstructing. There is the general prohibition on obstructing an officer. And by the way, I should maybe right where I have front, I should say, and those two species of obstructing are reflected in the two jury instructions on the offense of obstructing. There's not just one jury instruction, there are two. There's the 1766 and there's the 1766A. 1766 addresses the general concept of obstructing, the general prohibition on obstructing an officer that this statute creates. And in order to obstruct, under the general prohibition on obstructing, you've got to impede the officer in the performance of his duties, the language that you were referring to, because that's inherent in the concept of obstruct. Although I will say this, I don't know that you ever committed yourself to a definition of obstructs. In Hamilton, you assumed for purposes of decision that you would accept the jury instruction's definition and the state's definition in that case of obstructing. I don't know what you've ever, and I don't think you went any further than that in Hennies versus Morrissey, is that the name of the case? I may be wrong in that regard, you'll have to take a close reading, but I don't think you have ever committed yourself to a definition of obstructs. But the point I'm trying to make is there is this general prohibition in the statute on obstructing. The jury instruction reflects, and the state does not dispute, that when you're prosecuting a person generally for obstructing, inherent in the concept of obstructing is the notion that the officer was impeded. And if we were approaching this case Under that, I think we'd still, I think we would still fall within the statute because of the of the affirmative misrepresentation that were made here that in fact impeded the officer in the sense that it required him to engage in extra investigative activity that he would not have had to if it hadn't been for these false statements. But setting that aside, the jury instruction, not the jury instruction, but the statute also, however, contains within it a much more narrow and specific prohibition, which is contained in Section 2A, where the legislature has said that it obstructs, includes, without limitation, knowingly giving false information to the officer or knowingly placing physical evidence with intent to mislead the officer in the performance of his or her duty, including the service of any summons or civil process. And so what we have then is a separate and distinct and very specific species of obstructing defined by the legislature. And that's what is then reflected in Jury Instruction 1766A. And that's what Caldwell was concerned with. So Caldwell did not go out on a limb or...
Actually, didn't Caldwell result in the creation of 1766A?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true because Caldwell was... I'll tell you in a second here. Caldwell was decided on February 7th, 1990, and the jury instruction was created in 1990 without a specific date on it. I'm only assuming that if it was February 7th of 1990, the jury instruction, I don't think we'd have that kind of coincidence that in their January-February meeting in 1990, the jury instructions created an instruction that reflects Caldwell without Caldwell being in front of it. So I think it occurred later in 1990.
I have a...
Pardon?
Basic question. Just for the sake of argument, let's assume that the Court of Appeals has not defined the offense properly. Does it have any effect on this case? Or aren't we there yet?
You're saying it did not define the offense properly in Caldwell?
Yeah.
Well, I thought I touched on that in passing in my response.
I want to know, does it matter here in this case?
Well, It matters... Maybe it matters on the question of overruling Espinoza, but it doesn't matter under the facts of this case because this defendant impeded and obstructed. I mean, he obstructed by what he did, regardless of even if you add that additional element of obstructing, it requires that there be some...
This is an interlocutory appeal. We're not deciding whether he's guilty or not. We're not returning it.
That's for sure. Now, I'm saying... If Caldwell is wrong, this case still goes forward. I don't think it has any effect on whether or not you overrule Espinoza with regard to the exculpatory no doctrine. I don't know why that should make any difference. I mean, either somehow you find an exculpatory no doctrine in language of a statute that gives absolutely no basis for finding it. Or you don't, as we're saying you should. We're saying you should not find in a statute that doesn't create any kind of exception for an exculpatory no, an exception for an exculpatory no. And I guess that argument still stands regardless of whether Caldwell is right or not. Maybe further thought would lead me to a different conclusion, but that's at least my initial reaction.
I guess my question is, can't we just apply Pennis and Morrissey, and under the facts, aren't you still contending that the actions of the police officers were frustrated here because they had to go out and they had to find Triller and look for Triller?
I'm contending that, but I'm also saying you should not apply that because the legislature has created a specific species of obstruction that does not require that affirmative showing that the officer was somehow misled or that his performance of his duties was somehow impeded, whatever the language is of the jury instruction that generally talks about the offense of obstructing. We believe that Caldwell was rightly decided, and we don't believe that in a case that involves the knowing giving of false information with intent to mislead the police, the state is required to show any more. We don't have to make that additional showing that we generally have to make, and it was recognized in Hamilton and Hennis versus Morrissey. That being that, in the words of the jury instruction, to obstruct an officer means that the conduct of the defendant prevents or makes more difficult the performance of the officer's duties. We don't have to make that additional showing because the legislature has relieved us of that by telling us that obstruction includes, without limitation, giving false information to the officer with intent to mislead the officer in the performance of his or her duty, and they do not have any additional requirement that the officer actually be obstructed in the sense of having his performance of his duties made more difficult or impeded or whatever the language is in Hamilton and the language of the jury instruction. We're not required to show that. So I don't believe that you should resolve the case on that basis and send it back for a trial under that theory of obstruction, under the general definition of obstruction and what it requires to show obstruction. We believe the case should be tried under the Caldwell theory of what the
evidence is. I guess my question, and this is what I'm trying to hone in on, Mr. Becker, is assuming for sake of argument you're correct that this statute provides a means of prosecution, isn't there still, and this is what Hennessy and Hamilton stood for, isn't there still the obligation on the part of the state to show that the police were, in fact, obstructed?
The point I'm trying to make is that absolutely not, because the legislature has relieved us of that by its specific definition of obstruction in sub 2A. And that is reflected in the jury instruction that was created for offenses charged under 2A, namely jury instruction 1766A, where right in the jury instruction itself, on the fourth element of the offense, which is the defendant intended to mislead the officer, in explaining that element, the last sentence is, it is not required that the officer was misled. And we believe that that's precisely what the effect of the statutory language is, that it relieves us of making that kind of a showing. And the jury instruction reflects that, the jury instruction itself reflecting the Court of Appeals decision in Caldwell, which decision we believe was absolutely correct and unquestionably correct interpretation of the statutory language. And I see Justice Prosser is about to ask me a question.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm Officer Prosser, and your vehicle is weaving on the highway, and I stop you, and I ask, have you been drinking? And if you have been drinking, and you say no, there's nothing else said. Is this an obstruction? Do we have grounds for an obstruction charge?
If the state believes, in compliance with this court's admonition in Peters, that you knowingly made a false statement, and I guess you would know if you were drinking, and you made that with intent to mislead the police, I guess we would fit within the statutory language. And
now, go ahead. Mr. Becker, how fast were you driving? I'm following up on Mr. Weber's question now. And you say only 60 when I clocked you at 65. Obstruction?
That one, I suspect, would be very difficult to charge that one probably because of the requirement that it be knowing false information. And boy, there are so many possible explanations for a person going 65 and believing he's going 60. He doesn't have cruise control. He's been holding his speed at 60. He hasn't looked down at his speedometer in the last minute. He hasn't realized that his foot has gotten a little heavy and he's gotten up to 55 and he legitimately believes that he was only going 60.
You may have trouble proving it, but can you charge it?
Well, I think that's where this court's admonition, I don't think it would be charged because I think this court's admonition in Peters suggests that if you're going to have trouble proving it, you probably ought not to charge it. Could you charge it in theory? I suppose. I don't think it would get charged because of that. And I suppose a defendant could try and come in and say, I wasn't really trying to mislead the officer. I was just giving my best estimate of the speed that I was going. He had the information he'd gotten off of his whatever instrument he was using to clock my speed, so I wasn't really trying to mislead him. I was just giving him the information that I thought was correct.
What about in court? The only question in court of the defendant when the defendant takes the stand is, were you driving the vehicle? No. Is that chargeable?
I am burned up on perjury in response, in preparation for this oral argument. My opposing counsel said that it would be. There may be some law out there that I'm unaware of, but I would assume that it would be. Again, there's a case where, you know, as a matter of practice, defendants don't get charged with perjury for, you know, denying criminal activity in court, but that doesn't tell us whether or not they could possibly be. I don't know the answer for sure. I'm assuming that he's under oath and it's knowing and it's material. I mean, we're talking about a drunk driving prosecution, I take it, and he denies driving the vehicle. It's a material statement made under oath in a judicial proceeding. I assume that that's potentially perjury.
It would seem to me if a defendant takes the stand and says anything other than the complete truth about the defendant's involvement in a crime, you've got another charge here, according sort of to your theory. And if the defendant says anything to an officer out on the street other than the complete truth, it seems to me we're in that area that there may be another charge involved.
Well,
that's a little unsettling to me.
Well,
this is not to say that someone who sends an officer on a wild goose chase.
Yeah, I realize that. You're going at the question of whether or not some form of exculpatory no doctrine should be accepted or Espinoza should be affirmed, as opposed to the question of whether Espinoza extends to what went on in this case. And I would only say this. Perjury, I assume, but I, like I said, I didn't bone up on perjury. I don't know if there's some exception. I just know that as a practical matter, we don't do it. Prosecutors do not go back in and bring a second charge when a defendant has taken the stand in his defense and lied. That just generally does not, I don't think we see that. I remember it was a trial judge. I actually was never a trial level prosecutor, but so I think there's probably members of this court who were and that have a better handle on that than I, but I don't think, I've not seen that at the appellate level. With regard to obstructing, And your concerns there, I don't think there's any question that your concerns have some validity. That are we creating a statute that is so broad that it can be improperly, you know, has the legislature created a statute so broad that it can be improperly used by a prosecutor to just almost automatically, in any case where the defendant has been interviewed and given some false information, we can now add an additional charge of obstructing. I think the Ellis Court, I think the United States Supreme Court in Bogan, in their decisions rejecting the exculpatory doctrine, did not say that those concerns don't have some merit. What they said was they can't overcome the plain meaning of the statute. We can't write into the statute limitations that are not there, no matter how alluring the argument for imposing those limitations might be, because then you are crossing the line from your judicial function and engaging in a legislative function. And I think that if there are members of the court, and if Justice Prosser, if you're reflecting your view and you have these kind of concerns, I think the place you want to look is in the concurring opinion in Brogan by Justice Ginsburg. She had those exact same concerns that the statute, that as it was now being interpreted without the federal statute about the criminalizing going and giving false information, that statute, as it was now being interpreted without the gloss, or with the gloss of the exculpatory no doctrine, but had been adopted by many federal circuit courts, removed, as the U.S. Supreme Court did in Brogan, she was concerned that statute could now give rise to prosecutions in cases where one has a Bedman state, as I think Justice Prosser, you have, it should not be used. She said, I go along and concur in the abrogation of the exculpatory no doctrine, and I direct Congress's attention to this. And she not only directed Congress's attention to this, but laid out in her concurring decision specific language that she proposed could be adopted based on statutory material proposals that had been made over the years, and I don't remember if the Model Penal Code was cited in there or not, but there were a number of different ways she thought the problems and her discomfort could be dispelled if Congress would act to enact legislation that she was suggesting. But the point being, that's the legislature's function. If this statute is susceptible to abuse, although if it is, I don't think we see it. I mean, even before the adoption of the exculpatory no doctrine in Espinoza, we did not see routinely or even sporadically, I think very rarely, did we see charges of obstruction of justice because a defendant may have denied his guilt when questioned by police officers.
Mr. Becker, if indeed your position is that the activity that occurred here doesn't come within the exculpatory no exception, then why are you urging us to consider overruling Espinoza? Why do we have to reach out and do something like that?
You don't have to.
Why should we?
Well, I think you should because I think it was wrongly decided, and this is an opportunity this Court has to correct a manifestly wrong decision of the Court of Appeals. And I think that this Court's primary function under the two-tiered appellate system is law development. You said that in give you an armload of cases where you have said that. And I think you would not be fulfilling your function of law development if you had the opportunity to, this presumes that you come to the conclusion that Espinoza was wrongly decided and that it was, plainly wrongly decided. And I think that's the case. I mean, it relied on Brooks. Brooks has now been, in effect, overruled by Ellis. It didn't take into account Brogan, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Brogan knocks out all of the arguments for adoption of the exculpatory no doctrine. Now, Brogan is not binding on this Court. I recognize that. It's not a constitutional decision. But it is certainly persuasive. I don't know how you can read Ellis and you can read Brogan and you can look at the statute and you can consider your function in interpreting statutes, which is to apply the plain meaning of the statute, how you can do those things and not come to the conclusion that Espinoza was not just wrong, but it was egregiously wrong. And if you come to that conclusion, then I suggest to you that while you don't have to, you ought to, in fulfillment of your law development function, reach this issue. It's certainly presented by the case because it is an argument the state is making to fend off the defendant's contention that his case comes under the exculpatory no doctrine. One way of saying it doesn't come under it is to say that it doesn't exist. Espinoza was wrong. And I think you should take this opportunity then to correct what I think is an egregiously wrong decision of the Court of Appeals. You don't have to. You can avoid it. I don't think you'd be fulfilling your law development function if you did.
You don't think, starting from scratch, we could construct a compelling case for the same result as Espinoza?
I don't know how, because starting from scratch means you start with the statutory language. Unless you can find the statute unclear, or unless you can find that the statute is absurd or unreasonable, or potentially absurd and unreasonable in criminalizing exculpatory no's, and I don't think you can do that, because you may have concerns about whether or not it's subject to abuse. But as the Court of Appeals in Espinoza itself recognized, morality certainly dictated that Espinoza and now Reed answer police questions honestly and truthfully. And I don't think you can ever label unreasonable or absurd a statute that, in effect, statutorily mandates what morality requires. And if morality requires that you be truthful with the police, then a statute can certainly require you to be truthful with the police. Now, there may be other concerns expressed by Justice Prosser beyond that, that this might just sweep too broadly and just allow the state to add on additional charges when really, as a practical matter, they really aren't probably, justified in this, not that they're not justified in the statute, but that they're not justified in the real world my orange light is on. Bottom line, though, is what I said. If you're starting from scratch, you're starting from the statutory language, you can't find any basis in the statutory language for creating the functional equivalent of the exculpatory no doctrine. And since my orange light is on, my orange light means I've got 5 more minutes, doesn't it? I'm sorry.
You haven't been here for a while.
No, I haven't. Let me... I guess at this point you're probably going to get more or less stream of consciousness from me, just in terms of if you haven't already. in terms of responding to specific arguments made by my opposing counsel. Justice Crook's asking whether there's anything in legislative history that would support of our obstruction statute. Well, of course, we know that you're even about to go to the legislative history unless you've got some ambiguity in the statute, and we don't have that here. But put that aside, he said, well, there is none, and he's right. The legislative drafting file on this statute is got six or seven documents that don't tell us anything, as is usually the case with legislative history, especially when you go back to to the 50s. And he did point out that the federal courts, based, I think, substantially on the legislative history of the federal statute that was under consideration in those cases where the exculpatory no doctrine was created, that they did find in the legislative history a basis for the exculpatory no doctrine. And I would suggest to you that if you go back and read those cases, there probably was some basis because this was a statute they traced back to the Civil War. And it had been a statute that was not directed at criminalizing misstatements made in conjunction with police investigation of a crime. And so there was some basis in the legislative history for what they did. Of course, ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court said it doesn't make any difference. The plain language of the statutes trumps everything. And there's no exception, But the only point I'm trying to make is we don't even have something in the legislative history to grab onto, if it were even appropriate to look at the legislative history, unlike the federal courts. So I think the federal decisions are not persuasive at all in trying to determine whether or not our statute should be, as a result of someone looking at legislative history, our statute should be interpreted to have an exculpatory no exception engrafted on it. Is there anything else?
Is there any safeguard that you would propose in the statute other than the exculpatory no? We agree, maybe we don't, but I think many would agree, it's very hard if a police officer asks you a question. You're not in custody, right? You're stuck on the side. You're not in custody. You don't have the right to Miranda, right?
Right.
So the police officer asks you a question. It's extraordinarily difficult to remain silent. I suppose you could say I have the right to remain silent under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution in the same clause in the Wisconsin Constitution. That's a little dangerous, especially if you think you can talk your way out of this, which police officer may not give you a ticket, may not arrest you. You know, there's a lot of discretion in there. So you are going to have a lot of pressure on you to say something. And it's the state's burden to, at trial, not on the road, to prove you're guilty. So if you say to the cop, yep, I'm drunk, or you say, yep, I had X number of drinks, truthfully, that can be used against you, right?
Sure.
If you're silent in response to a question, that can be used against you.
Well, it can't be used against you if you don't testify at your trial.
The police officer can't say, what did he say to you there? And can't say.
As I read this court's decisions, and I'm thinking particularly of, well, Sorensen, it was cited in my opponent's brief also in that same volume of the reports is the Brecht decision. If we're talking about police questioning, in other words, questioning that implicates the Fifth Amendment, it doesn't implicate it to the extent that Miranda warnings are required, but it implicates it to the extent that you have the right to remain silent, that the Fifth Amendment confers on you the right to remain silent, then that silence plainly cannot be used against you if you do not testify at trial. It can, however, be used against you if you do testify at trial, but that's because the U.S. Supreme Court has said that greater concerns come into play, the truth, that you can't, that once you put your credibility in question by testifying, then we can use everything that's available to us, including that that silence. But
how about a Reed Weber warning at the roadside, where the officer says, "Anything you say can and will be used against you. If you tell the truth, we'll use it against you. If you lie, we'll use it against you."
Right. That was my next question. That's the dilemma. You either confess and tell the truth, or you're prosecuted for a false statement. That's what, in effect, Justice Glasser is saying.
Well, or you remain silent. I mean, you have.
But that's hardly
a choice. But that's the assumption we make, though, is that the defendants have that right, and that if they want to exercise that right, they can. Now, the decisions say that these are hard decisions to be made. The invocation of constitutional rights is, it's not a simple and open-shut decision for people. You have to weigh pros and cons.
But if you remain silent, I haven't reread this a while, aren't you required to give your name if you're asked?
No, that's precisely what I think you rejected in Hennis versus Morrissey, or I think that's
what the U.S. Supreme Court say.
I guess that's still an open question. At least that's what it was, an open question at the time you decided Hennis, and I don't recall any. Am I missing? I don't know if I'm missing something since then. But you don't have to. You do not have to respond. You don't have to give your name. And in this context, it is not obstruction. It does not fall within the obstructing statute to fail to give your name in response to police inquiry. Boy, if you're thinking about mandating any kind of warnings in this context as a prerequisite to prosecution of this statute, give me a chance to brief that.
There's nothing in the statute that says.
You would be doing the functional equivalent, but in a situation that I don't think at all calls for it, you'd be creating a whole new set of Miranda warnings. As you said, these would be the Reed, whatever, warnings. And I don't know how you do that, because it's one thing to create a set of warnings with regard to the Fifth Amendment, in an inherently coercive environment, i.e. custodial interrogation, as a prophylactic to protecting a constitutional privilege. I think it's quite another to create warnings in a non-inherently coercive environment, roadside traffic stop. U.S. Supreme Court has said that that's not the kind of coercive environment that requires Miranda warnings. And not for purposes of protecting a constitutional right, but for purposes of laying a prerequisite to prosecution under a criminal statute that does not require those warnings. I think that's reaching.
And the defendant doesn't have to know, in your view, that there is such a statute, and that lying under these circumstances.
No, that's clear. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. That's one of our most fundamental rules of criminal law. My red light is on, so
if there are
no questions, I can sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Good seeing you again. Mr. Weber?
Thank you. If I might start with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Brogren, I think there's no dispute from us that that's a decision which has some persuasive authority on this Court. We're not suggesting otherwise, but there are a few distinguishing factors I'd like to just point out to the Court. First of all, the intent element of our statute, Section 946.21, sub 2A, specifically incorporates intent as an element of the offense. That's not present in 18 U.S.C. Section 1001. There is no intent to mislead the officer equivalent in Section 1001. There's another important distinction, I think, in the federal case of Brogren. The U.S. Attorney's Office had a policy manual which specifically stated that prosecutions of this sort shouldn't be undertaken. Yet the Court found that there hadn't been the parade of horribles that was argued by the defense. However, this Court could certainly take a different view of that and consider the litany of cases that were cited in, as Mr. Becker pointed out, Justice Ginsburg's concurrence, in which she pointed out the number of cases where officers had taken on a case where the statute of limitations had expired and went over and questioned the suspect, officers who had proof of all the elements but one, perhaps, of the crime that they were investigating, specifically asking, going to the suspect and surprising them, showing up at their doorstep with a badge and asking them a question on the element which they had the proof to refute, and then charging them with the obstruction or equivalent felony charge in 18 U.S.C. Section 1001. Those kind of pressures are the kind of pressures that the court here is the phrase unsettling has been used to describe it, and that is the heart of our point. I think that the court should look at cases like Medina de Perez, the Ninth Circuit. I think that line of cases was also adopted by the Fourth Circuit of the Court of Appeals, where the court specifically wrote that in a post-arrest criminal investigation, and this applies with the same force here in this case, a competent governmental investigator will anticipate that the defendant will make exculpatory statements. A defendant who meets this expectation cannot possibly pervert the investigator's police function. And that goes to some of the questions from Justice Butler. In this case, Justice Prosser also mentioned the wild goose chase. Reed didn't send the police officers on a wild goose chase by his statements, in the sense that it is our position that Reed's statements were simply offered. His purpose in offering them was to deny criminal wrongdoing and the accusation of wrongdoing. The fact that the officer chose to track down those leads, even though he didn't believe Reed for one second, doesn't mean that the officer's duties were perverted. The
officer is doing something the officer would not otherwise have had to have done. As soon as he follows up on the lead given by the defendant, as soon as the defendant says it was Triller and the officer acts on it, that is activity that the officer did not have to undertake.
We respectfully disagree that the officer had to take that responsibility or that additional investigation in this case. The officer chose to do it because he was a thorough investigator who tracked down the lead and foreclosed Reed's defense. He didn't need to do it. He arrested Reed right on the spot. He didn't even undertake an inquiry down the road to see if Mr. Triller was walking one way or another.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't he arrest Mr. Reed for refusing to do the field sobriety test?
No. I believe that's true. But to arrest him for refusal to do the field sobriety test, he needed probable cause to believe that he had been drunk driving. So
he sees an individual behind the wheel of a car. The individual says, "I wasn't driving." He asks him for field sobriety test, and he says, "I wasn't driving. You can't have them." Now, under a probable cause theory, doesn't the officer have enough of a probable cause, yet still have a duty to investigate the leads that were given by the defendant to make sure that the defendant wasn't telling the truth?
In the sense that it's the officer's job to do a thorough investigation, I agree with you, Justice Butler. But I don't think that that's a perversion of the government's function. They created a stronger case by doing that than they would have had if Reed would have simply said not guilty and said nothing else. Then the defense could have showed up at trial and poked whatever holes in the evidence the state had without a false statement by Reed that's been disproved to show his consciousness of guilt, to foreclose any other theory that may come up at trial.
But the whole point is the officer would not have had to have gone out looking for Triller. It's the obstruction that's involved here. The officer had to do something that the officer otherwise did not have to do. That's the problem with your argument.
I understand, and I understand what you're saying, Justice, but our position is that this is just a quirk of this case. It's just a fact that needed to be investigated just like any other fact when the officer's doing an investigation. We don't think that Reed's intent was for the officer to do that, to be misled. And that's the element that's in this statute that isn't in 18 U.S.C. Section 1001. Reed had to intend that officer be misled into going on a wild goose chase, and that wasn't our position as far as what Reed intended. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weber, and thank you, Mr. Rebecca, for your arguments on exculpatory. No, that concludes our hearing in 03-1781-CR, State versus Reed, and we are adjourned for the January oral arguments, and again in February. You're adjourned.